Hello and welcome to Dialects. Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. Coming up this week, we interview Bob and Mary of the Bristol Against the Arms Trade about drones. We also took a trip back in time along the River Wyly.
We've got the next episode of Lady Stanhope's Diary, as read by Malcolm Grieve. James Burton tells us about his sport charity, United Through Sport. And we also have Robin Clapp from the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance. We've also got the What's On Guide, prepared by Jeff Sparks and read by Adia Layton.
Dialect is produced by volunteers and broadcast in Bristol, at least on BCFM and 93.2 FM. We also go out in Swindon on Swindon FM, and we also go out in Radio Verulam in St Albans. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, because this is a volunteering thing after all, whose office is just off Queen Square, and you can also look them up on the internet, Volunteering Bristol as well.
On the 2nd of April, arms manufacturer BAE Systems and others hosted the UK's annual drone conference here in Baldwin Street in Bristol city centre. There was a noisy protest outside and many of the conference people had to leave. I'm now joined by Bob Nichols and Mary Dobbing from Bristol Against the Arms Trade. Welcome.
Hello.
And you guys were protesting outside at the time. What was this drone conference you disrupted discussing?
The event was the 27th annual drone conference, hosted by a organisation facilitated by Bristol University, who have links with research and an aerospace. And it was composed, the conference itself was talking about developments to do with drones, so, which is the common name is a drone, but the technical name is unmanned aerial vehicles.
So just to kind of, if uninitiated, no one knows what a drone is, could you just really simply describe it?
The drone is like an aircraft, but there is no pilot. They're remotely controlled via a satellite link. For instance, British use drones in Afghanistan and have a squadron of RAF operators in Las Vegas in the USA. So the drone is launched in Afghanistan and then the satellite connections handed over to operators in Las Vegas at Creech Air Base, 7,500 miles away. And these drones can fly for 24 hours at a time, around 27,000 feet, and can read a license plate. So they hover about looking for what they would interpret as suspicious activity. They can carry armaments. So as well as surveillance, they can fire Hellfire missiles and 500-pound bombs, paveway bombs. So they've been likened to a PlayStation mentality to warfare, where the operator all that distance away is just using a joystick to shoot at that distance, at blips on a screen.
So this is highly sophisticated technology, and this conference was to discuss the furtherment of that.
That's correct. It is a sort of cutting edge, or one of the cutting edges of sort of technology for the military, the military's main development. The conference itself was purporting to say this was for civilian development, which is true in one aspect, but for the past 26 years, 98% of drones are military. So the civilian aspect is very small and will continue to be that, but it will grow. And the conference itself was talking about how the drones will be operating in civilian airspace. Currently, what's happening is Britain have a contract with TAL and Elbit system to develop. It's called a Watchkeeper programme, and these are ones that go, new squadron that will go out to Afghanistan, but they've delayed that so they can put these things into civilian airspace. They're not allowed to at the moment in the UK and the US. Why they're doing that, I'm not quite sure, because they're ones that are easily militarised, so why they would need them in the UK, which sort of one can speculate about.
I'm presuming your stance on the civilian use of drones, in inverted commas, is, you know, you're still against it because of the nature of, actually, drones are on the whole used for military and kind of surveillance based activities. What's your kind of, I don't know, feelings on the use of civilian drones?
In my experience, the talk of civilian use tends to be a bit of a whitewash for the military use of drones. I think in many quarters there would be civil liberties concerns about the use of drones for surveillance in civilian use. So there is, for instance, use of drones for the police, for border controls, for drug smuggling and things like that. So in my view, it just becomes part of a much more highly securitised society. There's some interesting developments of surveillance of the Olympics, for instance. There's a big security ring around the Olympics and drones are going to be used, apparently, for watching what goes on there. The softer uses of drones which makes them complicated to campaign about, is that they could be useful for surveying crops, for looking for lost people in wilderness areas and that sort of thing. But that isn't happening at the moment, and I don't see that that will happen very much.
If that's the 2% compared to the 98%, which is being weaponised or used for military purposes, I can kind of see your point of view on that one. In terms of the protests that you guys took part in with Bristol Against Arms Trade outside of the conference, kind of tell me more about that. What happened?
The conference itself was in the centre of town, which meant we could get there quite easily. And we decided that, and it's not something we've done before, was to have a noise demo, which was one way of peacefully disrupting the conference as best we could and getting our point across. And that's what happened. There was about 80 people came and we had a sound system, and there was a lady with an amplification, electric guitar and drummers, whistles, drums, all sorts of pots and pans. Yeah, so that's what we did for quite a few hours.
And what was the reaction?
The conference building itself is quite old and the windows are single glazed, so we knew it was going to have quite an impact. And it is very, you probably, readers know themselves, if you have something in the background that's repetitious, it does annoy you in the end. It's a very great distraction. And the people who were running it were very annoyed, and which meant we were being effective, really. So it's a good way of having a protest.
Definitely. So were the police called? What, you know, do you get any kind of press attention? What was the outcome?
Well, police were maybe intrigued and had quite a standoff approach to begin with. And there have been, discussions between the police and people who were all protesting. And the police said they were going to let us carry on as it was a peaceful protest. But I think there was various complaints made by the people who were running the conference and maybe other people around that it was just going on too long. And these orders were countermined, and the police decided like they were going to move us away. In quite, it turned out to be quite a rough manner, really.
What can you describe that? In what way?
Well, pushing us down the road, really. I mean, I think if they'd asked the person with the sound system to turn that down, or they would have confiscated it. So the sound system went down, and it was so the noise level went down quite considerably at that point. But we thought they wanted to create a space so people could leave the conference, but I think they wanted to clear us away completely. But you know, who knows what their logic is? But obviously they had decided they were going to move us on, and it ended up with a bit of a tussle at the end. Some people were arrested nearby and didn't appear to be doing very much, really. And then there was a sort of line of people who didn't want to move, and the police.
From your point of view, was the action successful?
Yes, I say it was, because the conference would have had no doubt about our presence and our message. There were a lot of banners as well, which I think spoke very eloquently of our message of not wanting arms traders and developers in Bristol having this conference for 27 years running. And I think there was quite a wide variety of constituencies there at the protest, representing many local groups whose campaigning issues impinge on the arms trade.
Just to go back to, fantastic that you protested in this way, in terms of going back to the people in the conference and their almost arm's length, not really necessarily understanding what these drones are necessarily going to be used for, because it's the technical side of it that they're interested in, or, you know, the research involvement with the universities. I'm just trying to understand kind of whether there's a moral implication, or how you do you try and reach these people in other ways rather than protesting at conferences and things like that. It's an odd question, but I suppose I'm trying to understand the people in the room and who these people are, and do they understand the variety of, you know, complaints against what it is they actually do.
Interestingly, one person who was invited, and I think he works in one of the universities, was going to talk about various ethical issues to do with drones and raise their awareness, as they may obviously be working for some sort of civilian contractor somewhere, not the military themselves, or a student, for example. But that person didn't go because he had other commitments, and he did just let us know, which was unfortunate. And sometimes we do find when we're campaigning against the arms trade that sometimes people have to be shaken up a bit, really. And we don't actually expect, it's the general public we really focus on, rather than people who are, you know, believe these things are either technically exciting or they've got a vested interest in the financial side. Obviously, the military contractors have not going to really change their point of view, although it does wake them up a bit in terms of there is some people out there, some where they know members of the public and a contrary have a viewpoints contrary to theirs.
I think that the shock is that this meeting's been going on for 27 years, and I think one of the main platforms of our campaigning about the issue is that there hasn't been a public debate about the use of remote warfare, and the genie is out of the bottle in terms of the technology, because it is there, and it's very difficult, as we know, in a lot of technological things, to put the technology backwards. So what we'd be campaigning for is that there is a public debate about the use of armed drones in warfare, because it makes warfare much more likely to happen, and for violent attack to be a response to conflict, and that the amount of money and business and sort of Great Britain PLC that goes into the development and manufacture of arms needs to be challenged, and that the amount of money that goes into the peaceful resolution of conflicts just doesn't equal that. So it's more the public that need to be aware of what's going on behind closed doors, and to get up to speed and bring the governance of these things and the democratic process into play, mm-hmm. and to have a voice and an informed voice to challenge drone warfare.
Are these things legal then? I mean, what's the kind of international law surrounding drones?
At the moment, there isn't any law that specifically refers to the use of drones. So many lawyers around the world, particularly in the US and beginning now in the UK by various groups, there is one legal case coming up about a young man that was killed in Afghanistan by a British drone strike, and the British government is being challenged, and there's a legal case coming up about that, and it's happening in the States as well. And Pakistan, which has experienced most of the illegal drone strikes, as we would say it, you know, with the CIA in America, is in a fairly public way bombing using drones in areas where there aren't declared wars, which is really very concerning, where there is no particular legal challenge going on. And this is very much against international law. And also the strikes by drones against individuals in Yemen, in Somalia, in Pakistan, in Libya, and many other places, mostly by the CIA, are extrajudicial killings. If your name is on the list without any court, without any evidence being brought, then you can be killed by a drone wherever you are on the planet. And the CIA's angle is that anyone who puts America at threat of terrorism, you know, more or less deserves to be killed by a drone wherever they are, whether there's a declared war with that country or state or not. And this is obviously very dubious in international legal terms.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time, but it's all very informative and interesting stuff. And if anyone wants to find out more about Bristol Against the Arms Trade and the kind of things that you guys get up to, is there a kind of a website or place they can get in contact with you?
Yeah, we have quite an informative blog site. It's Bristol Against Arms Trade, all one word, .wordpress.com. Got a meeting at Hydra Bookshop at 7 p.m. Wednesday the 2nd of May. Everybody's welcome. It's 34 Old Market. Well worth a visit to the Hydra Bookshop. It's that 2nd of May, 7 p.m.
Brilliant. Bob and Mary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We now go back in time once again to take a look at some of the wildlife that thrives in and around Wiltshire's chalk streams. Back in the early 1990s, Dalek Stone Gosling met up with the president of the Wiltshire Trust for Nature Conservation, Robin Broadbank, on Wiltshire's River Wyly.
My name is Robin Broadbank. I'm president of the Wiltshire Trust for Nature Conservation. And we're standing here looking at the mill stream of the River Wyly at Steeple Langford. Now, I'm looking down at it from a bridge, and we can see here exactly what a Wiltshire chalk stream should look like.
Now, the first thing I notice is that it's extremely clear.
That's quite right. The reason for that is that the water comes from springs and rainfall only. And that is good water coming from the springs, pure, very even temperature, which is an interesting point. And rapid flow is the other thing which keeps the water clean. And you can see here too the excellent green weed growth. The depth is much better at the moment because it's been raining the last 10 days. And the banks are well covered with rushes and water plants. And of course under the water, because these conditions exist in it, you'll find an enormous population of creatures, starting off with fish, of course, but a whole range of other creatures which thrive in this sort of water.
What are the most important aspects of the wildlife around here, do you think, that the river's supporting?
Well, the river's supporting huge numbers, as I say, of what are called invertebrates, which are creepy crawlies, to be blunt, and all the immature creatures like dragonflies and aerial flies, which have their caterpillar life, if you can put it like that, under the water, and then eventually emerge when the water temperature goes up and the food is there for them. And up they come, like the mayflies and caddisflies and all the things which the trout feed on, which are the biggest creatures living in the water, of course, the trout and the other fish.
What sort of trout live in this particular river then?
Brown trout, a certain amount of wild brown trout, but of course the river is stocked with fish from fish farms for the benefit of fishermen.
I haven't seen any trout since we've been standing here. Are there actually a lot of them around?
Yes, there are a lot of trout here. They're lying here under the weed, up under the banks. They are difficult to see. The river, as I say, is quite deep. It's a little bit coloured. The water's a little bit coloured, which makes it more difficult to see them. But when we move across to the other river over there, you will see fish. I'll point them out to you. But, of course, I haven't mentioned the bird life. This chalk stream supports a wide range of bird life, obvious things like coots and moorhens, dab chicks, swans, and large population of swans here, and a mass of small insect-eating birds which find their food along the banks, wagtails, herons, of course. There's a very large population. There is a moorhen going on down there, you see it on the water there. And that's a dab chick, little grebe, which is a diving bird. It will pop out of the water with it, there it's gone down. And here's a moorhen, just over that white scum under the willow tree there, you can see it walking about.
Now, you mentioned the white scum. It doesn't look very healthy, that.
No, a lot of people make this comment. In fact, it's an accumulation of bubbles. If you watch very carefully, there's a lot of bubbles coming down here. They're being formed by that little weir there as the water comes over it. And they float on down and they collect up in backwaters like that. And it looks like polluted scum, but it isn't. It's bubbles which accumulate into a large area like that.
And just quite healthy, really.
Quite healthy. The water's very pure. We hardly ever have pollution problems in the Wylie. And they mostly derive from slurry, which breaks out of farmers' compounds and gets into the water accidentally.
Are the brown trout the only game fish in the Wylie?
Salmon come up occasionally. They're not caught. It's not a salmon fishery here. It's a trout fishery. But I don't think people would dispute that if you saw a salmon, you might try and catch it if it was on your water.
For someone who's not experienced at fishing, is it feasible for someone to come and catch a trout here? I imagine there are licences and things like that.
Yes, you have to get a licence to fish, for any sort of fish, not any trout. You have to have a permission to fish. A lot of this is club water here. But there are private landowners who let people fish if they're asked. Well, once you've got the permission and the license, you then need the tackle. And most trout are caught on the floating dry fly, which is artistically cast by the angler upstream and floats down over the fish. And if you're on a good day, it'll take it. And then you've hooked it and you've landed.
But they're pretty difficult fish to catch, are they?
They're difficult fish to catch. There is another method, which is called the wet fly, which is an underwater lure, which looks like an insect as well. And you put that onto the water and you drift it downstream and bring it across the river. And then, of course, you can catch a fish too. And that is an easier way of catching it than trying to cast the dry fly upstream and catching the bushes and everything else in your efforts to put the fly over the fish.
But it's worth it. They're pretty tasty, brown trout.
Oh, very good. Excellent. And they run in these rivers up to a pound and a half. It's a very nice fish indeed. And of course, it's very exciting when you've hooked it. Try and get it on the bank. They get under the weed, you see, and then your line gets tangled out amongst the weed, and next to no time, you've lost it.
That was Robin Broadbank and Dialect's Tony Gosling on the banks of the River Wylie in Wiltshire, and that was first broadcast on BBC Wiltshire Sound back in 1993. Next week, why our rivers are so low, and Robin explains how modern privatised water companies suck water out of the natural aquifers under the ground, sometimes making streams and rivers disappear entirely.
Next up, we have another instalment of Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert, famous socialite and adventurer. read by Malcolm Grieve.
The party moved on from Nazareth to Sidon, which was rather dull, but no sooner had they arrived than Lady Hester received a most exciting invitation from the Emir Beshir, Prince of the Druzes, to visit him in his mountain aerie. The Druzes were a strange Islamic sect who lived in the chain of mountains between Sidon and Tripoli, and who were considered heretical by Orthodox Muslims. It was said by their detractors that the principal tenets of their faith were transmigration of souls, belief in there being no future, and approval of incest. Hester was understandably transfixed with curiosity about this tribe of people, and confided in Merion that she had intended to visit them even if she hadn't been invited. The prince, or emir, sent down a cavalcade for her use. 12 camels, 25 mules, 4 horses and 7-foot soldiers, and they set off for the Druze capital of Deir el-Kamar. The mountains were all but impassable. "I have travelled for 9 hours together and never found a place large enough to pitch a tent," Hester wrote to Crawford. "The vineyards are like staircases, and every little flat place stuffed with mulberry trees for the silkworms. The roads are horrible, and the people savage and extraordinary, the women wearing a great tin trumpet on their heads and a veil suspended from it, and seeming very proud of these frightful horns." Hardly an auspicious start. The frightful horns, or tonturas, were an important part of the women's costume, and served to indicate a woman's rank. The horn of a poor woman was made of pasteboard, while those of ladies of higher rank were fashioned out of silver and incrustated with diamonds and precious stones. The horns were generally held onto the head with long scarves, although the very rich used wide bandeaus of pearls instead. In public, the horn was always shielded by a veil, it being a grave breach of decorum to expose it to public gaze, far worse than exposing the face or breast. It was not removed even for sleeping, which must have posed considerable problems, for the horns were about 2 foot high. The angle of wear indicated which village the women came from. They could be vertical, horizontal, or at a rakish tilt in between the two. Lady Hester was received in the prince's palace with great ceremony and stayed there for a month. "They say he is a very good man," Merion wrote with restraint. "It is true he blinded his 3 nephews and had his prime minister strangled. But these things go for nothing in Turkey." The palace was not particularly beautiful, but the suffocating heat of the lowlands was swept away by the mountain breezes, and the building had been constructed so that a stream of water ran through every room, providing a delightful coolness. The emir himself was a tall, handsome man with a big bushy beard, strangely pale eyes, and great charisma. Although he was the religious as well as temporal leader of his people, this had not stopped him from recently becoming a convert to Christianity. Quite how he coped with this spiritual anomaly is not related, but Lady Hester was fascinated by him. According to one of her letters, anyone prying into the religious affairs of the Druzes was liable to be murdered, but it goes without saying that she totally ignored this risk. "I can ask questions no other person dares to put to them," she wrote. "But it would not be proper to repeat here those I asked even the sages, and still less their answers." Maybe it was all bravado, but she certainly managed to prove one rumour to be true. The Druzes ate raw meat. "I purchased of a Druze an immense sheep, the tail weighing 11 pounds, and desired it to be taken to a village. The villagers assembled and had a gruesome feast. The moment it was killed, it was skinned and brought in raw upon a sort of dish made of matting, and in less than half an hour, it was all devoured," she recalled with a shudder. "The women eat of it as well as the men. The pieces of raw fat they swallowed were really frightful." Whilst in the mountains, she also visited the Druze governor, Sheikh Beshir, who was a Lucifer compared to the emir. All kinds of massacres had been perpetrated at his command, and for fear of poison, he had an official taster for Lady Hester's food as well as his own. Lady Hester pretended to be used to it, but noted nervously that "this man upon his knees before me looked more solemn than usual." She survived unscathed and stayed with the Druzes for several more weeks before deciding to journey on.
Many thanks to Malcolm Groove there for reading another instalment of The Diary of Lady Hester Stanhope.
Hello to James Burton. You work for United Through Sport. Tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with United Through Sport.
Okay, well, I've been working in the travel industry for a number of years. I did a gap year in Zimbabwe in 1998. And through that, I saw opportunities in these countries to address some of the issues that were going on. I had a friend that also had gone off to Ghana in 1999 to set up a football academy over there. And we looked at ways that we can use sport as a different mechanism to empower young people over there, as well as building up an academy and giving kids the opportunity that do have sports potential to reach that ultimate goal.
That's quite striking. A lot of people just go on a gap year and have a nice time and then come home and forget all about it. But I mean, what was it about it that made you think, well, I can actually get actively involved and start organising this big project? And what do you think happened for you that doesn't happen for a lot of people?
I think there was clearly an opportunity in the market. If we're talking about the gap year travel opportunity, so thinking about young people in the UK that want to go off and try
so
and do their bit.
Before you went to university, was it?
Oh, yeah, I did my gap year. I then needed to come back and do my university education. Yeah. I felt like I needed to do that. During my final year there, this was always something that was at the back of my mind.
Okay.
To set up something to allow young people here that had a sporting interest to travel with that, do some skills transfer, and obviously work on their own careers and opportunity, but while they're overseas, they're actually addressing a wider issue. And essentially what we're trying to do is just using sport, it's not rocket science, for the benefits of obviously health, fitness and building life skills in these kids, but it's the wider picture and actually putting health messages, addressing education. And so we might run a fun HIV AIDS awareness session sport.
Yeah.
So that these young kids in these communities can kind of be role models and good citizens when they sort of take it back into their own communities and family setup, really.
Okay, so what did you do to go about setting up this body, you and your associate?
I originally set it up with a few friends, my brother, and we started organising the travel opportunities, really. I think we needed to kind of focus on what our objectives were, and I think there's two main programs. One is running a mass participation program, and that's obviously it's in the name, trying to get sport to as many kids as we possibly can. And then that's where the international volunteer experience helps run the mass participation program. And then on top of that, we have our own school of excellence. So we identify kids that have particular potential in the mass participation program to then be invited along to the School of Excellence, where they get extended sports support given to them, but also the academic growth. And
so what different countries in Africa are these places?
We're focused in South Africa, Ghana, Argentina, and we're doing a little bit of work in India at the moment.
So are these countries, you know, when you put this idea forward, okay, so we want to build this school and we want to get all the kids, are they quite enthusiastic about this, or do you have to persuade local communities to make them understand what it's about?
Not at all. I think what we're trying to do is we need to work alongside locals and find out what the kind of community need is there. But for example, in South Africa, where we've been working for many years now, the South African government don't even really recognise physical education as part of the curriculum. So in and around Port Elizabeth, we work with about 85 different schools, working with about 20,000 kids. And we visit about 3 schools per day, for an hour and a half each day for 5 days a week. And we literally deliver.
So it's literally getting out there on the ground, going from school to school, meeting people, saying, what are your needs? What do you want? How do we put this together?
Exactly. So it's working alongside what's going on in the country, but also we're working on a sort of a bigger global vision of we're knowing what works, you know, in different countries, but it has to be driven in at a local level.
And what sort of official recognition and bureaucracy did you have to go through, for example, in the UK as opposed to in African countries to sort of get yourself recognised?
From the UK side of things? Not a lot, really. I think, you know, you need to go about setting up a good governance structure and making sure that everything is transparent and what we're doing can be scrutinised. But we've set this up because we're passionate young people that have seen a need. And so to get these things up and running, it's actually not that difficult. The difficulty is getting your name out there and getting the community buy-in. And thank goodness the Facebooks of the world have allowed us to build up communities. But because we were one of the kind of original charities, certainly in the UK, to use sport in its name and sport as a tool for good.
Yeah.
We've been in the search engines for a number of years now. So even if you just type in sports charity, we'll come up top on.
And what events have you been doing recently here in the UK, and how has that translated into what happens in Africa?
Okay, so there's various things that we do. A lot of our returning volunteers who have spent maybe 3 months doing a coaching project with us will come back and join a university here, and they will do fundraising and they'll promote what they have done themselves to a wider network of other students. We also try and encourage people to get involved with our own fundraising ideas. So we run a campaign called Locker Change for Change. It takes an hour or two of someone's evening, possibly, just to go down to your local sports centre, and you stand there, and as people walk out, you ask them for their locker change in order to have some positive social change overseas.
Okay.
And it's very rare that people can walk past and not drop their pound into the pot. So we do need people to help us with these things, as well as the Gold Challenge, which I've already mentioned.
Okay, so what sort of different stuff have you seen happening to youth? How have kids developed and changed as a result of this, for example, in South Africa or Argentina?
Yeah, well, for example, we're now working in schools where those kids are actually receiving top-level coaching. And so the platform that that gives them to then go and play against other top-level schools and clubs is so much more than what they had before. So now attendance rates at those schools have gone up massively because these are the schools that people want to be part of because the opportunities are
absolutely
made available
to
them. We've also, with some of our kids, made it to play national netball, for example, or Eastern Provincial rugby teams. So we are giving these kids a lot of opportunity to even reach the top level of the game.
So you're getting a lot of support from recognised sports names, both here and abroad, from people who want to get involved in this coaching and...
Absolutely. We use South Africa a lot because it's very much a country that we've got some significant results from. But Roger Federer has been involved with giving us some support down in one of the townships in Port Elizabeth, where we've built 5 tennis courts, which double up as basketball and netball. And then that becomes a centre point within that community where all those kids can come and enjoy the sport. And we also run the curriculum into that as well.
Okay, so what would you really like to get across towards the end of the interview that you most want to leave people with?
Yeah, I think the big message at the moment is that we're not the only ones that are recognising sport as this powerful tool for social change. Nelson Mandela, the former president of South Africa, has said this: sport has the power to change the world, the power to inspire, the power to unite people in a way that little else can. Sport can create hope. It is an instrument for peace. And I think that that's something that's at the centre of what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
And even the United Nations and Ban Ki-moon has said kind of similar things alongside that.
So if people want to find out more, where can they go?
They can go to our website, which is unitedthroughsport.org. And on there, you can find ways that you can get involved from maybe a fundraising event, volunteering overseas, or even making a donation. So whether it's just supporting us in terms of getting equipment to kids overseas or even sponsoring a kid to receive a scholarship through our work would be much appreciated.
Okay.
And please join our Facebook communities and Twitter communities at @UTS Charity.
Indeed. Thank you very much. James Burton, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure to introduce Robin Clamp to the studio. Hello.
Hi, good evening.
You're a member of the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance. What exactly is your role in them?
Well, I'm the press organiser for the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance. We've been established for 2 years, and our job is to basically expose the real agenda behind the government cuts, to oppose the cuts to local jobs and services, to expose what's going on with the National Health Service, where up to half the beds in the NHS are going to be privatised. And we're now in the process of creating local groups across the city, which would be both responsive in terms of reacting to cuts that the councils make, but also will seek to reach out to ordinary people in their communities to alert them to things that they may not know are happening. And what we endeavour to do is build a mass campaign along the lines of the anti-poor tax unions in the 1990s. But this time, the aim of the campaign very clearly is to oppose all cuts to jobs and services. We didn't create this economic mess. Ordinary people shouldn't be paying for it.
Why don't some people sympathise but think that cuts do have to happen? So how can you be against all cuts? I mean, we can't go on spending money we don't have indefinitely.
Well, it's very interesting that in the last few weeks it's been revealed that there are £750 billion stockpiled by big companies in this country who can't see lucrative investment opportunities and are just sitting on that cash. There's £120 billion additionally that goes uncollected each year from the big companies by George Osborne and his friends. And in fact, if you're a millionaire or you're a super rich company, you get rewarded for not paying your tax. If you're an ordinary punter and you don't pay your tax, you get your collar felt by the Inland Revenue. So we reject the idea there's no money in this country. There was plenty of money to bail out the banks. The problem is the money is being taken from the public services. The government is using the so-called budget deficit as the excuse to make those cuts. But really what's going on is a quite naked ideological attack on the welfare state. Those bits that Margaret Thatcher never finished off in the 1980s are being carved up and sawed off to the private firms in order to give them a profitable outlet. So you've got the Royal Mail being sawed off, you've got schools becoming academies, and they will be forced in the future to turn to the private sector for their funding. You've got half the beds in the NHS, as I mentioned before, being made available to private health firms. American health firms are hovering around like vultures at the moment, just waiting to pick off those parts of the NHS they can make money from.
Now, of course, David Cameron does love to go on, or certainly did, about the big society. I mean, couldn't you perhaps be a part of a campaign group to be able to translate these cuts into some sort of community cohesive action to be able to provide these services?
Well, ironically, the very concept of big society was something that was largely in existence before Margaret Thatcher and her group came along in the 1980s and started destroying it. Thatcher very famously once said, there is no such thing as society. If you close a local library, if you close a local health centre, you're actually ripping up the fabric of a local community. If you take a local school out of local authority control and make it an academy, which is forced to look to the private sector for its funding, you're undermining community. If you don't build social housing in the most downtrodden parts of the city of Bristol, you're undermining community. So the big society is a complete nonsense. What is in fact happening is under Cameron and the coalition, we're seeing the return of the Thatcher idea that ordinary people can go without their public services if they haven't got the money in their pockets to pay for more expensive private services. And in the health service, we're rapidly going down the American road where, you know, the legend has it that if you go into A&E, the doctors will fill your wallet before they fill your pulse. And that really is the end result of the privatisation policies that this government is embarking upon. But it's also about the small local cuts that take place. The 1,001 ways that our communities are being eroded, and the consequence being that as people are without services, as unemployment continues to rocket with over 1 million young people now on, and it's going to get worse.
Surely, yeah, you know, communities being, you know, we're all members of community. We talk about community as though this is something that's happening somewhere else. But if I wish to be a member of a community or I wish to see more community, then surely it's just up to me to take that on board myself. I mean, surely the only people who corrode communities are the communities who allow themselves to be corroded in the first place.
Well, a few weeks ago, Bristol City Council made unprecedented cuts to its voluntary and charitable budgets. Many community groups in this city are now without funding. Other groups have had their funding cut by 50%. So all those people who are trying to put into the communities, who are spending long hours working to try and make their local communities better places, have received a kick in the teeth from a government which says in its headlines that they're in favour of a big society, but which in truth want people to volunteer to run services which beforehand would have been run by local authorities. And who are these people who have loads of time to run a local library, for instance?
Okay,
by getting rid of librarians and replacing them with volunteers, you're actually eroding the service.
Okay, that's those some good points there. So let's look at the more practical on-ground stuff that you've been doing to kind of combat these cuts. What have you been practically engaged in?
Well, one of the things that we're building towards at the moment is a citywide demonstration on Saturday the 5th of May in order to highlight what is going on with the National Health Service. We know very well that the ideological attack of this government against the NHS is motivated by a desire to open up the NHS to the private sector. That £750 billion, which is sitting idle in the bank accounts of the big companies, will be used at least partly to come into the NHS to make money out of patients. And so what we want to highlight is that the very concept of a national health service free at the point of demand is going to be undermined by these so-called reforms, which in effect are counter-reforms.
What can we do to stop it?
Well, I think it begins with informing people what's happening. It then is a question of getting people to see that by getting together, by joining together in groups, we can actually become a much more powerful voice. Many people are appalled at what is happening in Britain at the present time, but don't see an alternative. They shrug their shoulders and say, well, what can you do about it? And we're saying that actually by getting together in anti-cuts alliances across the city, across the county, across the country, we can have the same impact on undermining this coalition government's attempts to privatise our services that we were able to have in the early 1990s by getting rid of the poll tax. And the other aspect I would really want to underline is that the Anti-Cuts Alliance is also reaching out to all those in the voluntary sector, to all those who are facing job losses at the present time, and in particular are seeking to reach young people who are again being made scapegoats through government schemes like the bogus workfare schemes.
Yeah, and all of this is really going to hit them where it hurts in terms of electoral support. And we've seen recently in the news that Labour have opened up a lead ahead of the Conservatives. Would you like to see a Labour government come back in?
Well, I would like to see a Labour government if that Labour government pledged that it would reverse the cuts that are presently taking place. Unfortunately, Miliband and the other Labour leaders have put up the white flag in advance by saying that they can't guarantee to restore any of the cuts. So we have three mainstream parties who all now increasingly sound the same, who are made up of people who often don't realise what it's like to live in the conditions that we live in. And it's Tweedledee, Tweedledum and Tweedledems as far as I'm concerned.
Let's fast forward a little bit. What have we got coming up soon in terms of action that's taking place?
Well, we're doing a whole number of actions. I mean, one of the things we're presently doing is outing those shops in the city who are engaged in the workfare scheme. That's the scheme whereby young people are still being blackmailed to take unpaid labour in order to retain their benefits. And if they refuse to take those jobs, will be denied their benefits. So groups of anti-cuts activists turn up outside the shops, leafleting people going into the shops, making the point that these firms who could well afford to pay the national minimum wage are getting away not just with cheap labour, but with free labour. And that, of course, is having a detrimental effect on many other people who would be looking for paid part-time
work. So that would be sort of sporadic action taking place across the coming weeks. Have you anything else coming up?
I think the other thing, as I said before, is we've got meetings arranged over the next few weeks in different parts of Bristol, in Fishponds, in Bedminster, in Horfield, in Totterdown, to publicise the latest phase of the anti-cuts movement. And our message is that people who are angry with what is happening to Britain at the present time should not throw a brick at their television or should not throw a brick at the nearest shop and engage in rioting, but should put that energy into actually building a mass movement, a political movement that can bring down this coalition government. Okay. We need a government
of
ordinary
people. Where can people attend these meetings? Where can people find out more?
Our meetings take place on every fourth Monday in the month at the Friends Meeting House in Champion Square in River Street. But if you Google us or go online and type in Anti-Cuts Alliance, you'll find out details of all our meetings and activities. We're a fast-growing group, and we know the people of Bristol in their main are behind what we're saying. What we're saying is it's not enough to be passive. It's not enough just to be angry. You've got to actually get organised. And if we get organised, we are many and they are few.
OK, well, Robin Clamp, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure to introduce Tim Burrows to the studio. Hello.
Hi.
What have you got for us today?
It's a sort of country blues number called The Empty Road. It started as a spontaneous piece and I've kind of worked it up a bit.
Okay.
Thanks. Walking down the road all alone, looking for my girl, she's gone. Moon shines down a dim grey light. I stop a tramp and ask him for a light. Train passes by, it's going slow. His whistle blows kinda low. Knows where it's going, it knows where it's gone. It's going to Chicago. Mm-hmm. walking down the road feeling down. I'm looking for that girl of mine. She was here just an hour ago. Where she's gone, I just don't know. Love like a train, so they say. Can't tell when it'll pull away. Whistle blows, the steam unfolds. You're left on the platform all alone. I get home, it's after dawn. My bones will be cold, the fire's gone. Bed will be empty, the sky will be grey. Just don't know why it went away. Love's like a train, so they say. Just can't tell when it pull away. Whistle blows, the steam unfolds. You're left on the platform alone. Love's like a train, so they say. You just can't tell when it'll pull away. Whistle blows, the seam unfolds. You're left on the platform all alone.
Tim Burrows, thank you very much. Are you performing? Do you tend to perform out in public anywhere?
I've got some coming up in May. I'm going to be performing at the Bristol Folk Festival on Sunday at 11 on the Brunel stage.
Okay.
Isambard Brunel stage. Yeah, I have my folk and poetry night every third Sunday of the month at the End of Stars Boat.
Okay, the End of the Stars Cafe Bar is in the city centre, down by the docks.
By the falafel van.
By the falafel van, yes, the falafel king, at 8:30.
Yeah, 8:30 to 11. Yeah, okay, it's a lovely venue. So
it is very nice.
And if you want to perform, please turn up early because there's limited slots. So.
Okay, Tim Burrows, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Watson Guide of Jeff Sparks's origin, but via Addy.
Hello, this is your Watson Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 4th May, there's a Star Wars party at the Griffin in 41 Causton Street, Bristol. Dress to impress with your best Star Wars costumes. There'll be prizes for effort. The DJ will be playing the best of John Williams as well as the usual mix of rock and metal music. The event is free and starts at 7 p.m. Also on 4th May, there's a sea shanty night featuring Chris Ricketts' band, the Ali Browns and the Bristol Shanty Collective at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. On to Song of the Week, I present Van Morrison. Back in 1988, he performed with Lonnie Donegan and also Chris Barber in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And in 2000, the performance was released as an album titled The Squiffle Sessions. This is a track from that album and it's titled Mule Skinner Blues.
Good morning, Captain. Good morning, Shine.
Good morning, Captain. Good morning, Shine. Do you think that I'm your Skinner, working on your new road line? I like to work. I'm rolling all the time.
the time. I can carve my initials on an old mule's behind. I said, hey, little Wally boy, bring that Wally book around. Bring it, hey. You don't like your job, shut that water puppet down.
Van Morrison, Lorne Donegan and Chris Barber with Mule Skinner Blues from the album Discriffle Sessions. Into Saturday 5th May, The Doors Alive will be performing at the Orne in Victoria Street, St Albans. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on 5th May, Goldfish Don't Bounce will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts around 9 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Eddie, and thank you to Jeff Sparks. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you very much for listening to Dialect. Thank you very much to our guests. We had Bob and Mary of the Bristol Against the Arms Trade. We also had James Burton. And we also had Robin Clamp, who is the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance member who came in to chat to us earlier.
We had a feature from Tony Gosling. We also had another instalment from Lady Hester Stanhope's Diary, read by Malcolm Grieve. And we had the What's On Guide, provided by Jeff Sparks and read by Adia Leighton. The producer this week was Tony Gosling and our sound engineer was Michael Noyce. Many thanks for tuning into Dialect again.
Yes, indeed. From Michaela Dennis, himself, John Peters Coleman. Not forgetting, of course, that we recommend the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline. The number for that is 01454 318753. Thank you for listening and have a good week. Goodbye.
And I said to the man at the gate, give me a light that I may walk into the unknown. He said, go into the darkest place and put your hands into the hands of God. And so I gladly walked forth into the night. Yes, I gladly walked forth into the night. Well, I gladly walked forth into the night. I got his friend called Gabe, struggling with worthlessness, give himself more cuts than the ones given by the conservatives. Personalized conservative, hidden like a hermit, so no one ever loved him. He had never heard it, his father never told him. You would only scold him. So discipline was loving as character was molding. But behold, he was holding the heart, so cold it was evolving. And it was soul so controlling that a rotor that was close to him. And love was like a ghost to him. It would have meant the most. And what's the hear is right, I boast of him. You see, sticks and stones did break some bones, but a lack of hugs has broken him. Now I have never met another human being that hasn't had a past, that hasn't had an effect on their present. We live in an earth that looks like hell, it was made to look like heaven. And I know this pain relief, but what if pain was obsolete? What if we were made clean like Colgate on stained teeth? But are we not just children crying out for one to father us? I'm not Bible bashing, the Bible couldn't hear you hard enough. This is my conviction, I'm speaking to if you listen. No, it's not about religion. Jesus was not a Christian, he was Jewish. And these are his footsteps given a living. Hate to see the image given him to limit him. As this man that is controlling him, trying to throw him in the fire, do one little petroleum. When his arms are open wide and he doesn't intend on closing him, until you're close aside, you're the one that means the most to him. I did, until the man had the gain. Give me a light that I may walk into the unknown. Yeah. He said, go into the darkest place and put your hands into the hand of God. So I gladly walked forth into the night. Yes, I said to the man at the gate, give me a light that may walk into the unknown. He said, go into the darkest place and put your hand into the hand of God. So I gladly walked forth into the night. Yes, I gladly walked forth into the night. Well, I gladly walked forth into the night.